Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Well, if anybody's hovering at the door or comes in late, you tell them on Super Bowl Sunday. We got the $1,000 seats right up there. I don't even know what they're going for on eBay. Wouldn't it be great if people would pay $1,000 to come to church to study God's Word? As opposed to whatever that is. But I'll be watching. I'll be watching. I know poor Rebecca, though, will be watching with a little bit of forlornness about her Seahawks. Seahawks not playing.
Yeah.
We got the big seats up front. Didn't work. It didn't work. There we go. As part of my continuing introduction, which I thought I would kind of divide the introduction of the course up over weeks, and it goes well that way, because, you know, now that we've done a little bit, I could introduce a few things. And there are one or two points I want to make today by way of introduction to this course that I think will make a little more sense to you than they might have had I said them earlier. And one of them is, and you may be wondering, again, about these mitzvot. I mean, what are they? How do we find them? 613, you know, why is he teaching them in this order? So I want to address a few of those very, very quickly. Who knows how many there are? I mean, God knows how many there are. And we're doing our best to figure it out. You look in the Bible and you read things that look like some kind of instruction or guidance, and you say, well, there's one. Well, this has been going on for hundreds, if not literally thousands of years, to try to get to a sense of what they are. And it's a little bit of fun for students to go through the various sages and watch their differences and look at their differences. We're using largely the 613 as identified by the Spanish / Middle Eastern sage of the Middle Ages, Maimonides, who in Sefer HaMitzvot, which is probably the premier book on this, of his counting. But as I mentioned in the first session, there are others who count them differently. So just know that there's no particular magic to the 613. There are all kinds of numerology discussions of that number, which we won't get into. But so it's not like a fixed thing. I want you to sort of get an understanding of that.
Sandy, is there more than one mitzvah in some verses?
Yes, and we'll see several. In fact, there will be one coming up where one single verse has four mitzvot in it. In fact, we'll have one today that has two. So if there seems to be two instructions in the same verse, you know, I command X so that you do Y, or I command X and Y sort of follows, it could be two or three, and we'll see several of those, Mike. Now, the one thing I want to really emphasize is, so what is the magic or what is the meaning of the order in which we're studying them? And this comes significantly from Maimonides, who did not discuss them, as did many, in the order in which they appear in the Bible. Some look at them from Genesis through Deuteronomy and say there are 20 in this week's portion and there are 18 in next and 3 in the next. And a lot of people write, and they're very helpful, because as you read through the Bible the way we did last year, you could also be studying the mitzvot for that week. And you can get your lessons in their context, which is a wonderful way to study it. Maimonides said, no, I want to try to do them in some sort of order that has something to do with their meaning. And what I did, and it was just the most magnificent study for two or three years, about 20 years ago, and I've sort of picked this back up, and you all have given me a wonderful reason to really pick it back up, for which I'm very grateful, is I said, let's try to further group them so that we as modern people of faith can study them in some sort of order where they're grouped by topic. And that's what we're doing. There's no magic to this either. This is just Sandy Crest thinking based on Maimonides that this is a pretty good way to do it. So you'll see verses from all over the five books, but they're around a topic. And the topic that we're in now is relationship with God. And we're doing that in two parts. The first part, which we conclude today, are the positive mitzvot, about what we're really told, asked, guided to do with respect to this relationship. So love of God, cleaving to God, walking in God's ways. Today I call them the mitzvot of habituation. How do we get ourselves in the habit of being in relationship with God? And so these have been grouped together. I put these together so that we could have this kind of lesson. For the next two lessons, separated by a wonderful presentation by a missionary, is going to be a discussion of, and it's good to break them up, because now we're getting into idolatry. And I have put all the mitzvot related to idolatry together, and we'll be studying them over our next two sessions together. So, we'll do this with relationship with God, then we'll do it relationship with God's creatures, all the way from ourselves to our neighbor, to the weak, to the stranger, to the servant, to the enemy, to the animal, all the way across God's creatures, which is going to be a fantastic study. And then we'll talk about God's expectations of us relative to justice, God's expectations relative to family, and then we'll get into sacred space, sacred time, how we're to be with God. So, for the introduction. So today, we're going to get into these, I call them mitzvot of habituation. These are this is guidance practices that orient us regularly Godward in our duty toward God, in mindfulness and action. And we want to essentially get an understanding of how we manifest through our habits the kinds of ways of being with God that we've talked about in the last few weeks. Now, a lot of what we're going to do today has to do with Jewish ritual practice, which, of course, you don't engage in, and Camille and I, to a large extent, don't either. So we're going to try to understand it and its meaning, and we're going to try to understand what equivalents or what other kinds of ways of habituation might be or are for you. In fact, I want to start with that question. Here's the question. In what ways, we talked about this a continuation of our discussion last week, in what ways do good habits help us be better people? That's sort of the core question. Why are habits important? How can habits turn bad? This is a four-part question, any one of which, of course, you can answer. How can habits turn bad? And importantly, I want to ask you, before we get into this discussion, what habits do you have in your life that bring you closer to God, that make you be or act or feel more Godward, bring you in spirit, mind, and action to being with God? So I really want to get to the last question, but in it, I want you to obviously anticipate and talk about what is it in that that's important to you.
In the Protestant tradition, I think, we have sacraments that we do on a regular basis, and those just to remind you of things constantly. And I think that's one way of keeping
good. Absolutely,
I would think. And our two are communion and baptism.
Absolutely, I would think that through those, we talked about that a little bit last week. The participation in that is something that you do. It's ritual. It's got the feeling of habit. It happens regularly. And it, I suspect, in the experience of it, it brings you Godward. Okay, others? Yes.
I think of habit with a repetition.
Yeah.
And the bigger repetition, you can drill down deeper. Think about it more. It's always kind of in your consciousness.
Good. I like that. There is something regular about it, and it turns something on. When you do it right, all of a sudden the mindfulness comes. And the orientation, and oh yes, oh I remember, oh I'm back there again, this is, oh, I'm reminded. All these factors, I think, Paul, are what you're talking about. Yeah. Others?
Praying daily.
Praying daily. Mm-hmm. So that is something you do that puts you in this way of being on a regular basis. Good. Absolutely. Rebecca.
Several years ago, I studied Jewish prayers that you recite at different times of the day for different things.
Right.
And I started incorporating some of them into my daily prayer life. And starting off each day with thanking God for restoring my soul to me and for bringing the sun up and for bringing me food, and reciting the Shema, and reciting it morning and night. And it, there are days where it's just like I'm just going through the words, not really feeling it. But another thing I learned from studying Orthodoxy in Russia is sometimes you just need to keep at it,
mm-hmm.
and it will come to you at different times in your life. And I think that's a lovely thing to look at ritual, that sometimes we are just doing it, going through the motions, because you're human, and that's okay. But to have faith and continue with those rituals, because you will be drawn closer to God as time progresses.
I like that answer a lot, Rebecca, because what you've done is you've pointed to the flaws of ritual, mm-hmm. the flaws of habits. That is where they seem to just not have meaning, or become or seem to be routine, or I'm just doing this. But you're saying that if you keep at it and you keep searching, even though we have those moments, you break through, and the regularity of it is worthwhile, because in the end, fairly frequently, you're back into the spirit.
And it's an anchor for you.
It's an anchor. So I bet you start the day pretty well. I mean, you either start that, or you could start, you know, listening to pundits on TV, or bad music, or being angry about something that happened the day before, or you could be mindful of God and the hopes and the expectations and that warmth one gets from those kinds of feelings of prayer, of meditation in the morning, of thinking about these words. Anything else? We'll go on. We'll get into some of these. Yes.
How it can go bad is if you make your habit into an idol, and that's what your worship is.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. I wanted to get that out, because we certainly saw in our study of the prophets a concern on the part of prophets. And I think we see this in the teachings of Jesus, too, that when these rituals become idols, when you're doing it for its own sake, we see this in the entire prophetic tradition. To think, God says very vividly in the prophets that, no, don't substitute rituals that you have that should be facilitating relationship with God. Don't let that become something that you worship and then go out and act in ways or be certain kinds of ways of being certain kinds of people in certain things you do that are completely contrary to God's expectations. When they become an end unto themselves, as opposed to a vehicle to, or a facility, or a path toward, then it turns bad. The habits turn bad. And that can happen. That's a little more, Rebecca, take that kind of, this feels routinized or mechanized, take that a little further to, I'm into this, but it doesn't take me anywhere, or it takes me to justify kind of what I want to do anyway.
I'm okay. I'm a good person because I said my prayer this morning.
Exactly.
And in the prophets, when God speaks to the prophets and says, your sacrifices are repugnant to me.
Exactly.
They don't mean anything.
Well, not only they not mean anything.
They don't carry them what they're supposed to do.
That's the point. God wants the regular attendance. But God does not want the regular attendance. God wants the regular attendance to be a facilitation of being with God and God's expectations, not an end unto itself that kind of justifies or permits you to continue on some path that is against God's interest. Okay, good. So let's get into some of these. Mike, who's reading?
Well, I forgot to recruit anyone.
Well, that means you do it. So we're starting with Deuteronomy 6:13.
The Lord your God you shall fear, him you shall serve, and by his name alone you shall swear.
Okay. It is there are several in here, but it is the swearing. By his name alone shall you swear. That's the mitzvah. That's the direction. And it has been used principally to mean that when we come to moments in our lives when we are to swear, such as in court, we swear only by God's name. Why is this important? Why is this a habit? Why is this something that we do that's important enough for it to be merit a mitzvah?
To do otherwise would be like swearing on a false idol.
I think so. Why? Why would it be why would it be, why would we say that in moments in which we are to swear, and I want to ask you what those moments are and what we're doing in those moments, but why in the moments in which we are to swear an oath or the verity of what we're saying, that's what we're talking about, why would it be in God's name?
Well, if what you're swearing by is the ultimate authority,
right,
the ultimate authority, that's God. Now, if you just say, by my honor, I do this, that's not a tie.
Okay, good.
And it's also maybe putting yourself as an idol.
I like that. So when we swear by God's name, we're swearing by the highest authority. And we're giving, if we're God-fearing people, I guess we're also saying, this is the greatest assurance or security or partner or reference by which we could say something that is to be truthful. Other thoughts? I saw a hand over here. Yes.
I think it's you're bringing in a third party. It's equal. It's easy to be a good person, and I can be a good person to you, and I can be honest at work, and then I can be alone and maybe think about embezzling. But if I always have a third party in my mind upon which is the checking point, the swear point, the ground zero in my life, then I believe there's a third party watching or present.
And how wonderful it is, I think in line with that, how wonderful it is to have this practice of when we owe our fellows the truth, when they need the truth to be told, such as in court, that we bring to mind and we bring to our voices God's name. We swear it by God. This ties truth to God's presence. As if to say, we value the truth so much that we associate God with our telling it, which has the effect of saying, for God-fearing people, that on God's name I swear this, which is not a very good thing to do if you don't intend to tell the truth. But it also says to all the people listening and the people who are dependent upon your telling the truth that you're bringing God in as a third party to the statement of truth. This is a very, very important idea. Mike, let's go on to Deuteronomy 6, 7. And there are two mitzvot in here, and we'll focus on one of them.
Recite them to your children and talk about them when you are at home and when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise.
Okay, what they're talking about is the Shema, the first part. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Praise be God's name, whose glorious kingdom will be forever and ever, or whose sovereignty we honor forever and ever, depending on how you translate that. This is said a lot. Rebecca mentioned it. This prayer is said a lot. It is said in the morning. It is said in the afternoon. It is said in the evening. It is said when a person is near death. It is said, this is the watchword. Why would saying those particular words be an important habit? Whether you say them or not, why would you, just listening to them, think that, hey, I get why that can be made a habit? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Blessed be God's name in honor of sovereignty, of God's sovereignty forever and ever. You say that all the time, habitually. Why would that be said? Why would people who make a habit of saying that do so?
Since I say it.
Yeah.
It starts my day with why I am here and why, what I am to do here, that everything I do, everything I think, the speech that comes out of my mouth should all be reminding of who God is. The world belongs to God. My day belongs to God. My speech, everything belongs to Him, and He is sovereign. He is King of absolutely everything. And it governs every single little thing I do, even if it's just vacuuming my house.
Well, I want to jump on the last point. All of what you said is beautiful, but I want to jump on the last point. For me, every time I say that prayer, you know, we talked about belief in God. We talked about beliefs in our last two sessions. And we talked about following God and cleaving to God and loving God. What happens every time I say this prayer is I go to God's sovereignty. That's where I go. And it is very meaningful to me. It is very meaningful to me that God is my sovereign. And that's where I go. And so every time I say it, I feel that. And it gives me a sense of my place, my duties, for whom I'm working, to whom I serve. And so you say it, and when you can say something regularly, habitually, and it can throw you into a way of thinking, whatever your problems are, or whatever loneliness or uncertainty, if it throws you back into it, corrects you back into it, that's what I consider to be a good example of a mitzvah of habituation. Are there words, I know this is a Jewish prayer, Rebecca happens to say it, I say it, but are there words that you say regularly? Words, not actions. Are there words you say in prayer or in meditation? Just a few words that do this for you. And what are they? Yes?
When I wake up, a lot of times I say, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And then there's a Presbyterian catechism that, what is man's only comfort or hope? I forget what the noun is. What is man's only comfort? Not the sheep name, but what is man's only comfort in life? And it's that in life and in death, I belong to God.
Yeah.
And to me, that's about as deep as I can.
Yes. That gets you centered.
Yeah.
That gets you centered. I hear it. Yes.
There was one I saw in a, years ago, but it kind of stuck with me. Was, today is God's gift to me. What I do with it is my gift to God.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I may start saying that myself. That's fantastic. What do you think about this business of saying these words when sitting, when walking, when lying down, and when rising up? What does that mean?
Lying down and rising up refers to an evening prayer right before you go to sleep and a morning prayer when you first.
I think that's its explicit meaning. I think that's the way it's read. It's meant to say these prayers in the evening and in the morning. But then there's this idea of when you're sitting and walking and rising, and what is the purpose of saying those things? I mean, I think in one respect we get to fairly easily to the traditional view that these words are to be said in prayer at different times of the day.
An extreme version. There was a special on TV about 3 or 4 years ago about the Greek Orthodox monks on Mount Athos.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic CBS special in which they went there and filmed them and talked to them. And it's in their tradition, they have to say called the Jesus Prayer, which is a very short prayer.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to say it 10,000 times a day.
So
they filmed these monks out there working in their gardens and growing things, and you could see all their lips moving. They had these cameras focused on, all their lips were moving the whole time. They were saying it over and over. And they talked to one of the monks there, and he was actually from Milwaukee, but he was over there. And they said, why are you doing this? And he said, it keeps your mind on God, and it keeps all that other stuff away.
Even life can be distracting.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, Mike, because I think that's going exactly where I want to go with this. Rebecca.
Well, so in our tradition, Paul the Apostle has an admonition to pray without ceasing. And that comes from his Jewish life, where there was also an admonition that you are to be in a state of prayer 24/7.
Uh-huh.
So these are labeling the chief actions that a human being goes through your day. So it's not just pray in the morning, pray in the afternoon, but pray when you're making breakfast, pray when you're driving to work, pray when you're having lunch with someone. When you are marinated in prayer, it just oozes out of you. And
yeah.
That's what your life is to be. And that's what the Orthodox do. The Russians have the exact same thing they do. You're supposed to just keep praying all day long.
Beautiful. Are there other thoughts?
Same thing. She just said it more beautifully.
There's nothing like an amen or I agree. Those are good. Those are good things for people to do. Y'all are hitting it really good here. This is really where we're headed. And I'm going to... This is part of a big idea. This is part of a really big idea. These mitzvot are fundamentally about bringing God, bringing oneself and God together all the time. That's the goal. If I can find a way to be mindful of, if I can find a way to be close through these habits, if I can find a way to love, cleave, walk in the ways, serve, if I can find ways to be with God all the time, that's my goal. And I want it as regular as possible. I want it as often. I want to be God-directed. I want to be near God. I want to understand and be these ways to God as much of the day as possible, regularly to be sure, with on the road to all the time. If we're God's servants, if we're going to be a holy nation, if we're going to be priests in service of God in the world, the goal and the strategies to the goal are bringing us Godward as much as we possibly can, as much time as we can. I don't know, 10,000 times a day. Maybe it's 20,000 times a day. But it is regularly. And that is really what these mitzvot are significantly about. We're going to talk a lot about it. We'll talk a little bit toward the end about our next topic, which is idolatry, and what idolatry fundamentally means. But I'll save that for just a little bit. Yes?
Why wouldn't it be better for those priests to be actively doing something than saying 10,000?
Good. Good. Good for you. We're going to talk a little bit more today about what...
Teresa was praying by her actions.
I'm going to ask you.
But these were not priests. These were monks. Priests don't do this.
The monks. You make a very good point. Ways in which we do these things. What we do in lieu of some of them, or in addition to some of these, we're going to get to in a minute. So let's go now, Mike, to 6-7 again. But I want you to look at the final clause, the first clause. I'm sorry, just the first clause of 6-7.
Recite them to your children.
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you. Don't want to confuse anybody. Okay, recite them, teach them to your children. We talked about this when we went through the Torah. We saw it in there. And you'll recall we learned that it's not just children. It can be disciples. It can be the youth. It can be each of us to each other. We recite them. We teach them. And so if we're going to recite them, Maimonides says there is something precedent to the reciting. There's something that comes before the reciting. What would that be?
You have to learn them.
Right. Exactly. You have to learn them. So the inherent mitzvah, there's something inherent in the mitzvah, which is not stated explicitly. And this is a really important thing. In order to recite them, in order to teach them, one must learn them, know them. Be able to be fluent in them, have the desire, be effective in it. All of that makes you, you can't just go out and be the quarterback in the Super Bowl. You know, there's a lot of preparation. And just as they're here in the teaching, in the reciting. This is very, very important. There's some beautiful words in the literature about students and teachers. And I just wanted to share some of these. They are called, in various places, by sages, beloved of God, lover of God, friend, saintly, upright, faithful, brought nearer to virtue. And this one makes me get a little emotional. It's just beautiful poetry. A never-failing spring. That's what learners and teachers are. And I would just say, as we get into this, which of these rituals do I find that habituate me mostly? It is study and learning and discussing, as we are right now, the Word of God, which leads me to a closeness and duties and action, going to your point, that I think are pleasing to God. And so I find every time I study in preparation of this or just when I'm feeling lonely or anxious or suffering, every time I study, I get somewhat closer. I get some of that same feeling we're talking about, obviously with prayer and other things. But we'll come back to this topic in a moment. 6-8, Mike, Deuteronomy 6-8.
Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead.
You remember we discussed this when we hit it in Deuteronomy. They're talking to traditional Jews about tefillin, where there's really literally a wrapping around the arm opposite the heart that has a container in it, a small leather case that has certain words in it, largely focused on Shaddai, on God. And the wrapping goes to one's forehead where there's a leather box on the forehead. And that is wrapped at different times of the day for these prayers, largely in the morning. And Mike, when this wrapping is done, the person recites these verses from Hosea. Well, let's read those two, chapter 2, 19 and 20.
I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and in justice and in love and compassion.
Okay, keep that in your mind because I want to ask you a couple of questions about this. Now, obviously, Christians don't do this, and non-Jews don't do this, and a majority of Jews don't do this, the wrapping of the tefillin. But let's just go ahead and try to figure out, for the ones who do, what are they trying to connote? What are they saying? What does that ritual mean to them? Remember, on the arm opposite the heart, on the forehead, is the Word of God, and these words that Mike just read from Hosea are recited when that's done. So first I want to ask you, what's the significance? What are these habits designed to bring into the lives of the person who's engaging in that ritual, would you think? Yes.
Well, something that occurs to me is saying, is attaching the thought to what you do, because with your hands you do things.
Beautiful.
And what you think, because with your mind you have an inner world.
That's it. That's exactly right. It's designed to direct one's arms, one's action, one's doing, one's heart, opposite the heart, and what one's thinking. It's designed to say, I want to bring God into what I think, what I feel, and what I do. And that's what happens. It brings on that frame of mind where you feel as if your body is being directed by God. Another way of thinking it, which I think is particularly lovely, is it's a way to support the soul. Because in effect what it's doing is it helps the soul against its neighbors. Think about that. The soul has got a pretty tough job, you know, dealing with a powerful body in which it's located. And the body wants to do a lot of things that are at odds with the soul. This is a way for the prayer to say to the soul, I'm with you. And I'm directing the body to operate in concert with God's expectations, which God has given us through our souls. I think that's a very, very nice way to sort of see that practice in addition to your fine answer. Now, what does the reading of Hosea at the time one's doing it, do you think, mean? Mike, do you want to read that really quickly again?
19 and 20 again?
Yeah.
I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice and love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord.
Why do you think that's read when this is done? What does that mean?
Because we are prone to wander and be unfaithful.
Yes.
And Hosea is the story of living with unfaithfulness.
Yeah.
And getting corrected.
Yep. Yep. And correcting his life and those around him, too, helping them to be faithful as well.
Daily wedding. A daily wedding.
That is it, Camille. That is it. It is a daily wedding. It is a repeat of wedding vows. That, I'm on the positive side of it. I mean, as opposed to, I don't know why that was so funny. I meant to just say to the audience, the source of that humor is befuddled at the laughter. I just meant to say, as opposed to a warning against faithlessness, another way to look at it is, y'all are going to have to explain this to me after class, why that was so funny. It's a repeat of wedding vows. That is to say that every day, think about that. Every day, I repeat my wedding vows to God. And betrothal, the betrothal is to God. And remember, We studied this. This is why this is the habituation mitzvah. We studied that walking in God's ways, cleaving to God, so many things mean understanding. And when love of God, we love God because we love God's attributes. Remember? And the attributes of God that we know are mercy, compassion, loving kindness, righteousness, and justice. Those are God's attributes. We love God, and in loving God, we love God's attributes, and that is what calls us to the marriage. And we commit to live in a way pleasing to the beloved. And so when we read Hosea, when we're doing this, when we're directing our body to operate in sync with our soul, we're repeating wedding vows in which we say, I love you, God. I am betrothed to you. And what attracted me to you are your attributes. I want to, in my life, I want to direct my arm, my heart, and my brain to operate in a way that's in sync with what brought me to the love of you. You see, and that's really just, I think, fantastic.
And it's also a witness to others.
Yeah. Yeah. It's done visibly, outwardly. And it is a way of saying. And in a sense, we also have that mitzvah, remember, of sanctifying God. What does it mean to sanctify God? And one of the ways is to live visibly, outwardly, explicitly, openly, as servants of God, as faithful to God.
Unexpectedly.
Unexpectedly. Yeah. Yeah. I think all that's exactly right. Mike, let's go on to Numbers 15, 38.
Speak to the Israelites and tell them to make fringes on the corners of their garments throughout their generations and to put a blue cord on the fringe at each corner.
Okay, this is the tallit. I have one as a part of show and tell. This is my very own, given to me by my beloved wife. And here are the fringes. This is a prayer shawl, and these are the fringes, and there are lots of things that are done with them during prayer. But wraps this around. I will say that the blue is no longer done because the practitioners thought that it was a unique blue that came from a certain mollusk, I think, that no longer exists. So they don't know the blue, and the blue doesn't. Now, the blue was designed to signify, we could talk about that a lot, but I want to use our time for other things. It reminds us of the sea. It reminds us of heaven. It reminds us of God's throne. And so it was something visible that we could see. But this is worn, and the thread is tied in certain ways or numbers. It's sort of a seal, as if a seal of the master. This tallit is designed with fringes. Now, by the way, people don't wear a tallit all day, but they will wear a little version. Those who are ritually in the habit of doing so will wear a little small version of a tallit that has fringes that they can feel during all the time during the day. And the purpose of this is, again, as a reminder. If one has those tallit, one remembers. It's a way of saying, I am bound to follow God's guidance. That's what the ritual is for. One sees it, one feels it, one's reminded. Oh, I need to be sure I'm living the way God wants. There's a very famous story in the Midrash of a very prominent rabbi. I don't know, I guess I can tell this story in church, but it has a lovely ending. It's a little weird. Who was tempted. By a wayward woman, if you know what I mean. And they were making some pretty good progress toward, doing something. How do I say this in a PG sort of way? And right before it gets too far along, he sees his tallit over in the corner of the room. And it reminds him. It reminds him, and I kind of like that story, and he says, no, I don't think we should do this. It's not the right thing to do, not the right, but you're beautiful and all this sort of stuff. It's fascinating. The story actually goes on to where this completely wayward woman is so impressed by this practice and by someone who says no to her because of God and all this sort of stuff. She ends up becoming a woman of God. They get married, and they lead a rich, virtuous, and religious life. Anyway, I don't know about all that, but it's actually, you know, the interesting thing about stories is I can never forget that story. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, whether I wear the fringes or not, I think about that story when I'm tempted. You know, I said, well, you know, there's a rabbi, and you know, the fringes, and I should be on the up and up. That's right. I remember that. Exactly. Just the fact that she gave it to me is a reminder. Let me see. I'm tempted to go do this. Oh, I got to remember. My wife gave me this Ellie. Anyway. So now.
Maybe the larger one.
Yeah. Because I got a large problem that I have to curb. Now, you remember when we studied the tallit, when we studied fringes, when we studied this verse in the Bible, do you remember what else we talked about the fringes maybe mean? If I'm wearing this, and I have the fringes kind of sitting right here, do you remember what we talked about them also mean?
The outskirts of society.
That is to say, I'm mindful. If I'm wearing this and the fringes are extending out here, I have the fabric on me and the fringes are going out toward Rebecca or toward any one of you. And the idea is that they represent that space. They go into the space from the fabric, from me to you. And I think about that connection through the fringes. So I think about my duties to you. Love of neighbor, love of others. My connection to, and the fringes, it literally brings up the idea of my duties. Remember the trouble people got into when they were unmindful of the fringes of society? It is as if to say, I am, the core of our community is the fabric of the tallit. The fringes are as we get closer to the outskirts, people we don't know, people to whom we don't have a traditional duty. But it is to say, they are connected to me. Now put that in your mind and think about it.
What's the blue cord?
Well, the blue cord, again, is this idea of the unifying theme of the whole enterprise is God's throne in heaven. The blue shows us heaven is part of the fabric of all of this. It represents God's throne and God's presence as we interact with each other. I think of God. I'm duty-bound to God. I'm duty-bound to you because I'm duty-bound to God. It ties in the themes of this church. Love of God, love of neighbor. They're wrapped up together in this ritual. Now I want to go on to 6:9. Deuteronomy 6:9.
And write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gate,
that you may do them and be, and I am your God. I think it goes on to say in the next phrase. Here's a mezuzah. This is what is ritually done to embody the mitzvah that Mike just read. And this is a container that is into which certain pieces of Torah text are placed, okay? And they allude to the one God and our duties to hearken to Him. That's what the text says. And this is put on the doorposts of the house. So on an entryway, for example, you'll see this kind of leaning like this, and it's there. Traditional Jews will actually kiss it when they go into the house. What is the purpose of that, do you think? Why would people do that? What would it mean? What could it mean to them?
It's a reminder of blood on the doorpost.
Okay. Okay, so in other words, it brings us back to a sign that happened in our history,
right,
of God's protection, and God's redemption of us. Good. That's a really good answer.
As
yes.
For me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Good. That's exactly right. Rebecca.
I guess my response is a little more mundane, and that when you have such affection for the word and the teachings of God, you want to actually kiss that, and it's your expression of affection for that.
And why the house? I agree with all this. Why the house? Why would we want this on our house?
Because that's where you're most at home or comfortable.
I think so.
And what is it about being comfortable at home that we think about? We think of it as a sanctuary, don't we? Yes.
This is a habit which I have fallen out of, this particular habit that I was talking to Sandy on the way here. Most Jews, even those who are not observant, will have a mezuzah on the door. You'll often see that's pretty standard. And so they're on our door. But the habit which I've fallen out of late, which I'll, after this class, try to get back into, is when you walk in your back door, front door or wherever, some families put them on every door, the children's room. We have them on the door in which we go into the house. But you touch it and you begin to, the verse inside is, teach these words faithfully to your children. Speak of them on your way. It's that verse, the Shema and that. So, you know, you're more mindful about the way, maybe you're not going to walk in and just be very negative or be in a bad mood and just dump on everyone. You know, it's just a kind of a reminder of, I'm going in my house. I'm going in my house and I'm going to be a person of God.
Well, that's important. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think we sometimes take our family for granted. We think we can dump on them. I mean, you know, they're there. We're upset. I mean, this happens in our house. I don't know. Is anybody where it doesn't happen? This is saying, no. Be careful. Be careful. Be careful on the inside to those people who are
pointed. It's tilted inward.
It's tilted inward. Bring these things in. This is a sanctuary. And also, be hospitable to those on the outside. Everything that a house is about, yes.
It's kind of like animals, how they always make you happy. They're always happy when you come in the door. My dog's always happy to see me. You know, even if somebody else isn't. Kind
of like, so we need to be like our dog.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
They always come wagging.
Yeah, yeah. Be like your dog. I we're going to have an end of the year test, and anybody who answers, the mezuzah is about being like your dog, gets extra credit. Yes.
But it's also a reminder that people are going in your house, who reigns in that house.
Exactly.
Right, your habits in that house.
I love that. That is exactly right.
It's creating the sacred space in your home. It's not just in the temple or the church. It's in your home. And then it grows deeper as we go behind the clothes. It goes into your mind as a sacred space. Your body is a sacred space.
This is so true. Wonderful thinking. You know, so, traditionally within Judaism, once the temple fell, the altar was moved to the home. And in fact, we think, and we've talked about this as a shared learning, that the real altar is inside the soul. So I think you're right, Rebecca. This is saying to us, there is no sanctuary of God that shouldn't be respected and treated as if God is the sovereign in that place. And especially in the home, for reasons we've just talked about. Mike, let's, yeah.
Again, why is it tilted?
Not altogether sure, but I think one lovely interpretation is, as you go inward into the house, bring this idea into the house. You're coming into the house, bring these notions, these feelings, these commitments to God in with you. Okay? Mike, let's go to 31:19. I have two verses here, 31:19 and 17:18.
Read both?
Okay. Yes.
Now, therefore, write this song and teach it to the Israelites. Put it in their mouths in order that this song may be a witness for me against the Israelites. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law in the presence of the Levitical priests.
Okay, why should a king, this is a ritual, this is a mitzvah. So when a person elevates to kingship, becomes the king, he must write a scroll of Torah himself. Why? What effect would that have on him and his subjects and the community? Why do we say it's a mitzvah for the king to write a Torah for himself? Yes.
It's a internal and external submission to higher authority.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Absolutely. How often do we tend to think when we rise to power, or somebody rises to power, or a king would be powerful? The thought for so many centuries was, you know, le roi et moi. I am the king. I'm the king. Or I'm God's agent here. This is designed to say, no. You can be royalty among the people, but you have a king, right? You have a king, and you're duty-bound. I think that's what you're saying. You say it internally and externally to the community, kind of like the other one. This is something that's done publicly. You're right. The king is now writing Torah. What does it mean to be writing Torah? It could be literally. It could literally be, and it was taught. It's taught by some sages that it is literally to write down all the words. You have to take all the characters and you have to write it down. What else could it be? What else does it mean? I think you've said it, but I want to get people to flesh this out a little bit. What does it mean to write out? Because then it says we have a mitzvah that we're to write out our own scroll. That was the other part of what Mike read. The king does and we do. What does it mean to write out a scroll?
It means to live it out.
Get into that with me.
Keep yourself humble or keep yourself in line.
Y'all are getting to it.
That the laws have to be in accordance with the Torah in some ways, or the things that he governs his people have to be accountable to the Torah.
Good. It's as if to say that when I issue an edict, the laws I pass with respect to the king, the ways in which I rule the territory, these have to be in sync with the Torah, with the mitzvot. I have to rule in accord with them. That's exactly what it means.
Not driven by ego, like some of the politicians.
We talked about the bloated self. You know, back in Leviticus, we talked about the bloated self and Sarat being a condition that is manifested by the bloated self. This says to a person easily susceptible to the bloated self, the powerful politician, the king, I rule here. This is designed to say to them, no bloated self. You are subservient to God as are the people and rule that way. These are the governing principles of a leader. And it's not, they go against the idea of power. They cut against that sort of arbitrary power, and he submits to the standards, as we all do. Now, for us to have to write a Torah, to write a scroll ourselves, all of us to write a scroll ourselves, and I realize these are Jewish mitzvot, but what could they mean to all of us? What are we doing here?
Studying.
What are we doing here in this class? What do you do in the Dearman and in the Christian
God, growing our spiritual self.
Yeah. I would argue that in a way you're writing a scroll right now. We're writing a scroll right now. We just think about all the things we've done together. We've read. We've written. We've talked. We've put all of this into technology where it's constantly available. The writing, the talking, the thought, the spirit, the searching of yourself that you've done, the answers that you give, the questions that you ask, the discussion that we have together. I would think this is a writing of a scroll. This is what's meant. Camille's mother used to say that. We used to talk about what does the writing of the scroll mean? And she used to say, it's writing your life, writing the way you live. How you live in accord with these things is writing the scroll for yourself. That's really what it sort of is. Let's go quickly to ask you about this, Mike, rather than read it. There's the next verse commands us to have an after-the-meal prayer. And it's one of the most important of the mitzvot. It's deemed that way throughout the tradition. Now, people were also to have a prayer before the meal. So I don't want you to think somehow that when we, you know, conventionally say a prayer before the meal, and these crazy folks come and say it after the meal. They would say it before and after. What's the significance, you think, about saying the prayer after the meal?
Well, I recall we actually discussed this when we went through the Torah, when this verse came up.
Mm-hmm.
The answer then was, once you've finished a meal and are completely sated, that's when you're least likely to be appreciative to God.
Don't you think so?
You're happy right now.
Yeah.
And you've forgotten where you got it from.
I think we hit the nail on the head back then. Don't you agree? It's like I prayed, I got the food, now it's good. I'm feeling great. Nap time or you kind of forget that it was God's gift. And then you say, now afterwards, you say, no, I'm feeling great. I prayed because I needed the food. I was hungry. Now I've had the food, and I'm still praying. Think about that a little bit. I'm grateful, sated. I'm grateful. I understand, you know, the expectations of me. I understand the discipline. I understand the limits. Even sated. Especially when sated. Kind of a nice idea. Other thoughts?
Quick addition to that in answering, in having prayers answered, we go richer and deeper because we then can, at that point, we need to remember that it's He who answered our prayers, He who gave us that whatever, and broadened the whole perspective that we have. He's in charge. He's all powerful. He is our sovereign. And then having answered that prayer that we have so fervently and so seriously offered, and we need to go back and say, I realize you are you're in charge.
Yes, yes.
It confirms all we had, but it also makes it richer and deeper to go, keep going back to the source. And I know that's repetitive.
No. Beautiful.
Because that's where we need to go in the first place. When we remember to say thank you afterwards, it confirms that's where we needed to go and continue to do that.
I love that. Beautiful. Thank you for that. Camille?
I think a person can have a lot of fun with these in recreating modern ways of being. I mean, I'm all admiration for the Orthodox who literally do all of them or many of them. We do some of them. But even if you don't, you could take your Bible and touch your forehead and put it on your hand. You know, do it, living out the tefillin. You could take your religious piece of jewelry as sort of your reminder. Prayers. I just think something near your door, you know, it could be a lot of fun.
I think so. I think it's worth worth pondering these things in our lives. Again, whether they're done exactly the way traditional Jews do them, it seems to me they're instructive. I hope they have been for you. I hope they, because the idea, again, is what do we do? And I want you to think about this. And we'll talk about it a little bit next week as sort of our intro. We've run out of time. But I want you to think about the things that you do, want to do. Camille just suggested a few ideas of things that we could all do. Holding the cross, looking at the cross. I mean, whatever it is we do that brings us into the mind and spirit of who we want to be with God. And to do it in an ever-increasing way, more of the day, more of our time, ways of reminding ourselves when we least expect it, all at different times during the day, making us mindful. This is what these mitzvot fundamentally are designed to do. Next week, we're going to start two lessons separated by 1 week off. We're going to talk about idolatry. And I want to introduce idolatry to you, because when we get to idolatry, I'm going to ask you, what is it? But what I want us to throw out as a hypothesis is that what it is at the core is that it is ways of being that take us away from God, that reduce. We've talked about expanding the time where we're with God, duty-bound, loving, walking in God's ways. That's what's expected. I want to suggest to you that the Bible's concern with idolatry, fundamentally, and there's plenty of it, there are twice as many mitzvot on idolatry as there were in the positive love and duty to God. And the reason for it, I think, is this tremendous anxiety and concern and warning that there are things in our world, forces, beings, ideas, temptations, that pull us away and contract, shorten, brief up, lessen our time with God. And we are taught both to expand and not to contract. And we're going to have a discussion about idolatry beginning next week. Everybody have a good week. See you then.